Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. Capella's programs teach skills relevant to your career, so you can apply what you learn right away. See how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu. This message comes from NPR sponsor Synchrony Bank, empowering you to tackle your savings goals with flexible access to your money and no monthly fees or minimums. It's never been easier to take control of your financial future. Go to synchronybank.com/NPR, member FDIC.
So wonderful to have you join us for Here and Now Anytime. We bring you news of the day to keep you in the know and some music, arts, and culture to help you kick back. So go ahead, subscribe, follow, and share. Lots ahead for you today, so let's get started.
A bump stock is this aftermarket device that you, before the ban, could buy and attach to a rifle to fire at a rate similar to a machine gun.
The U.S. Supreme Court rules bump stocks are legal, striking down the ban against them. It is Friday, June 14th, from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Shirley Jahan. On the show today, we take you to what may seem like a fantasy place, a land before asphalt or concrete ever hit the ground. Come on along for that ride. Then,
help me, I think I'm falling in love too fast.
The life of a living legend, looking across decades at the many sides now of Joni Mitchell.
It was that total devotion to music making and creativity and art making that drove her.
First now, bump stocks. The U.S. Supreme Court allows them back on the market, striking down the ban against them. The Trump administration had outlawed the add-on that makes semi-automatic guns fire faster. That happened in 2017 after the deadliest mass shooting in American history. A gunman used bump stocks as he fired more than 1,000 rounds into the crowd at a Las Vegas music festival, killing 60 people, wounding hundreds of others, all in a matter of minutes. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court's conservative majority ruled the Trump administration's ban was an overreach of power. Chip Brownlee, gun violence reporter with the nonprofit newsroom The Trace, has been covering the case and talks with Peter O'Dowd.
So first of all, it seems to me that a key question here is whether a bump stock converts a rifle into a machine gun. And machine guns have been illegal since the 1930s in this country. So why don't you start by defining some of these terms here? What's the main difference between a machine gun and a rifle with a bump stock?
Absolutely. That was the biggest question. So a machine gun, as I'm sure a lot of people know, is a gun that if you hold down the trigger, as long as you're holding down the trigger, it just continues to fire bullets until you run out of ammunition. Most guns that are, you know, in circulation in the U.S. are semi-automatic weapons, which fire typically one shot per trigger pull. A bump stock is this kind of aftermarket device that you, before the ban, could buy and attach to a rifle, and it essentially uses the recoil when you fire the gun and uses that recoil to kind of bounce and make the trigger continue to fire, the gun to continue to fire at a rate that's kind of similar to a machine gun. And so what the Trump administration ATF did was they banned those devices under those laws to say that those devices essentially amount to a machine gun because the rate of fire is so similar.
I see. Now, this is the point that Justice Clarence Thomas was making when he wrote the opinion for the court. He said that a semi-automatic rifle with a bump stock is not a machine gun because it doesn't fire more than one shot for every function of the trigger. So what else did you read in the majority's ruling?
Right. So I think one of the big questions going into this case was whether the Supreme Court was going to look at the ATF's broader authority to regulate other types of kind of dangerous accessories that can be added to guns. And they kind of sidestepped that question and focused very specifically on these definitions that are in federal law for machine guns and bump stocks. So they really kind of kept it technical. But that that could in the long run have other implications for other types of regulations that the ATF is trying to put forward.
What are you referring to specifically? Because as you said, bump stocks, they're not the only devices on the market that can help people fire a rifle more quickly. What else is in there? And it sounds like you're saying those devices are not affected by this ruling.
Right. So there's other types of accessories that the ATF has tried to regulate. One of them is a pistol brace, which can essentially, it's like a stock that you can add on to a pistol to make the accuracy better. The ATF's tried to regulate those. But I think probably the nearest kind of comparison are what are known as like Glock switches or auto sears. These are little devices that go inside of the gun and essentially can convert like a normal pistol into a machine gun that just fires as long as you're holding down the trigger pull. But I think because this case focused so specifically on the definition of machine gun and bump stocks and was really looking at the technicalities of this particular accessory, it doesn't have kind of like the direct implications on those other types of regulations that it could have had if they had issued a kind of a broader ruling, I guess.
Mm. Yeah, and we should note, this is not a Second Amendment case technically. It's about the power of federal agencies to regulate. And so just briefly, you know, remind us who the plaintiff was in this case.
So the plaintiff in this case was a Texas gun advocate who had had to give up or turn in some of the bump stocks that he owned. And so he brought the case, and it eventually made it into circuit court, where the circuit court ruled in favor of him and then eventually made it up to the Supreme Court. But as you noted, it's not a Second Amendment case. This was really kind of a very technical thing about the definition of machine gun. But what that means is essentially if Congress wanted to pass a law today or tomorrow to ban these devices, the Supreme Court essentially endorsed that. And in fact, 17 states and the District of Columbia already have laws in place that ban bump stocks on the state or, you know, local level. And so those regulations will stay in place. Those are not, you know, at risk here because of this ruling.
And to your point, Congress could act tomorrow. They could act tomorrow. I guess the question is, would they? I think that this is notable because the Trump administration, a conservative Trump administration, was the one who brought this ban forward. Just briefly, your response to that.
Right. I know. I think that's very true. I mean, we've seen how dysfunctional Congress can be. So whether even if they agree on something, that doesn't necessarily mean that they can get it passed. And initially, the NRA and gun groups didn't really oppose the Trump administration's attempt to ban these devices, but later did. So I think we would see more conflict about that now.
Chip Brownlee from The Trace, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, an ocean of grassland. The sights, sounds, scents take you back in time. And we'll bring you right there, as if you were standing in the middle of the country hundreds of years ago. Stay with us.
This message comes from NPR sponsor IBM. What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create. This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Greenlight. Want to teach your kids financial literacy? With Greenlight, kids and teens use a debit card of their own, while parents can keep an eye on kids' spending and savings in the app. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/NPR.
If you want to know what a great expanse of this country looked like before the cities, before the farms and highways and the cacophony of modern life, may I suggest a trip to the Tall Grass Prairie National Preserve in Kansas. That's a bumpy road. I'm inside a pickup truck that belongs to the Nature Conservancy's Tony Capizzo. We're smashing over a washboard road in the 11,000-acre preserve. A few cows graze on knee-high grass, and a blue, cloudless sky blooms over the horizon. Then, at the crest of a hill, Capizzo stops the truck. We've found what we're looking for.
We're seeing one of the core family groups.
A family of bison. Once on the brink of extinction, this herd was reintroduced to the preserve in 2009. And today, a few rust-colored babies frolic in the morning sun.
They were nicknamed red dogs because that orange color that they have when they're born.
And their mama's just swishing their tails. They're happy eating grass.
Yeah.
Does this, in a way, kind of take you back in time a little bit?
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the spots where you can look out and see what tall grass prairie would have looked like historically. Bison grazing in little family groups around the landscape.
The Nature Conservancy and the National Park Service co-manage this preserve. It was once an old cattle ranch, and for 12,000 years before that, it was indigenous people that cared for the land. Outside the truck, its grandeur becomes clear. And not just to the eye.
While we've been out, we've heard some grasshopper sparrows, eastern meadowlarks, and upland sandpipers.
A sonic stream of katydids and grasshoppers drenches our ears. The bugs are hidden, unseen beneath the grass and forb.
When I say forb, it's kind of this catch-all for every non-grass species out there. Wildflowers is another way to think about that.
What's this pretty purple one?
So we're seeing some wild alfalfa, lead plant.
Antelope horn, milkweed, and pitcher sage.
Big blue stem, little blue stem, switchgrass, Indian grass, and side oats, gamma grass.
A botanical garden that reads like a poem.
Tallgrass Prairie originally was one of the ecosystems that defined North America. It would have covered over 170 million acres. And just for a sense of context, that would have started in Canada, gone south almost all the way to Mexico. We're about on the western end of Tallgrass Prairie right now in eastern Kansas, but it would have stretched east all the way through Iowa, Illinois, into northwest Indiana.
Oh my goodness, 170 million acres?
Correct.
It's not like that anymore.
No, only 4% of that 170 million acres remains today. Most of that of the Tallgrass Prairie was converted primarily to row crop agriculture, especially in those states, Iowa, Illinois, where there was really deep soil, it was perfect for farming and row crop agriculture.
So the landscape that we're looking at right now, we can just see forever. Is this what it looked like 500 years ago? Like if someone from that time were to be placed right where we are today, what would they think?
They'd be hard-pressed to find differences. There would have been a whole host of wildlife, everything from pronghorn antelope to grizzlies and wolves to elk and bison.
Wow.
A lot of the early written accounts talk about this ocean of grass. Like the only metaphor that compared to this endless sea of waving grasses was the ocean and those endless waves.
Oh, I can see it. Ecologically, from an environmental point of view, why is this grass so important?
Yeah, the Flint Hills really represent the only big piece of Tallgrass Prairie that we have left. Personally, I feel, and if you asked a lot of the ranchers around here, they would feel similar, that there is intrinsic value in having this place, that the biological diversity that's here represents a piece of kind of our American heritage that's worth preserving for its own right. It's an amazing carbon bank. Tallgrass Prairie sequesters almost as much carbon as an old-growth forest. The difference is all that carbon is held beneath our feet. Tallgrass Prairie roots can go up to 30 or 40 feet below ground on a really big scale.
I can see in the distance out here not only some happily munching cows, but some trees, which I understand are not a normal part of the landscape. So tell me about those trees.
Yeah, so woody plant encroachment is the way we talk about it.
Otherwise known as trees.
Otherwise known as trees and shrubs.
Okay.
No, so woody plant encroachment is one of the main threats facing Tallgrass Prairie today. Historically, if you would have come out onto this landscape 500 years ago, you would not have seen this many trees and shrubs moving into those prairie streams and taking them over.
So what happened?
First and foremost, European colonization really brought a lot of fragmentation to the landscape. Through the Homestead Act, there was a lot more trees that were planted with all of those different homesteads. And so all of a sudden, there was a more of a seed source. We're also learning from places like Kansas Prairie Biological Station about how increased atmospheric carbon is shifting the dynamic in Tallgrass Prairie.
Oh, in other words, those trees suck it up. They love it.
Yes. So they have those trees and shrubs, they have a competitive advantage today that they would not have had 500 years ago.
I've never heard anyone who cares for the environment say that trees aren't a great thing, right?
Sure.
But here, they're not.
Right. Trees are amazing in the right place. This place has a long evolutionary history of being open, treeless expanse. And a lot of the wildlife that call this place home depend on that. And so if we think of a greater prairie chicken, it's kind of a grouse.
Sage grouse.
Yes. Yeah. It's a grouse that's evolved for Tallgrass Prairie. Mm. Those grouse, when they look at a tree, what they see is a threat, right? When they've got a brood, that tree is likely to have a red-tailed hawk or some other kind of predator in it. And so they will avoid habitat around that tree. And so as trees invade the prairie landscape, you effectively start losing a lot of available habitat for some of our most important conservation species.
When you stand here, and I know you're a scientific-minded guy, right? But when you stand here underneath this warm June sun, hearing the katydids and the meadowlarks just flit through the grasses, how do you feel? What does this place do for you?
Yeah, I feel so fortunate to be able to be out here and to work to conserve this place. I grew up in Michigan, where there wasn't any prairie. My first job with the Nature Conservancy was on a Tallgrass Prairie restoration in Northwest Indiana. And while I was there, I read a book. It's called Prairie Earth by William Least Heat Moon. It's a 800, 900 page massive book. It's written about this one county in Kansas, Chase County, Kansas. Population here is maybe 2,400 people. The book just talks about this endless expanse, horizon to horizon, of Tallgrass Prairie. And that image, while we were working to recreate a little piece of Tallgrass Prairie in Indiana, was just, I don't know, I kind of got the bug. So to be able to be out here now and help contribute to conservation here, it feels really special.
The Nature Conservancy's Tony Capizzo at the Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve in Kansas.
We've got lots of stories of the climate crisis and climate solutions at our website, hereandnow.org. Coming up, the complex, brilliant, beautiful, and artful life of Joni Mitchell. From small cafes in Canada to the folk rock Laurel Canyon years to the jazz scene and ultimately rising again to a newer warmth within her older, deeper voice. Robin Young brings that to you next. Stay with us.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor, Lisa, in collaboration with West Elm. Discover the new natural hybrid mattress, expertly crafted from natural latex and certified safe foams, designed with your health and the planet in mind. Visit leesa.com to learn more.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Midi Health. Women in midlife face a healthcare desert. But Midi is here to fill the gap, offering expert care for perimenopause and menopause covered by insurance. Hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, weight gain, and moodiness don't have to be accepted as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians understand how these symptoms can connect to menopause and prescribe a wide range of solutions. Book your visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor Vionic Shoes. Solve your need for the ultimate travel-friendly flat-pack shoe on the market. Vionic's Uptown is equal parts style and performance technology. Use code NPR24 to get free shipping on your order at vionicshoes.com.
I'm Rachel Martin. After hosting Morning Edition for years, I know that the news can wear you down. So we made a new podcast called Wild Card, where a special deck of cards and a whole bunch of fascinating guests help us sort out what makes life meaningful. It's part game show, part existential deep dive, and it is seriously fun. Join me on Wildcard, wherever you get your podcasts. Only from NPR.
I am on a lonely road and I am traveling, 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 looking for something. What can it be?
Whether you're 20 or 80, we're willing to bet you've heard Joni Mitchell's music. Maybe you came of age in the late 60s, early 70s with the albums Clouds, Ladies of the Canyon. Or maybe it was her mid-70s turn to jazz with the likes of Herbie Hancock, Pat Metheny, Charles Mingus, Jaco Pastorius.
No regrets, Coyote. We just come from such different sets of circumstance. I'm up all night in the studios and you're up early on your ranch.
But no matter how big a fan, there's a good chance you've just been skimming the surface, according to the new exhaustive inquiry from NPR music critic Ann Powers. The Joni Mitchell she found is the Canadian only child born on the prairies who struggled with the paralysis of polio, then didn't stop moving when she could move. But don't dare think of her as a folky fairy queen born on a lily pad. She made her way in a man's world. She could be acerbic, imperious. She demanded respect. She broke hearts for quite some time. She dressed in disguise as a black man. Was that appropriation? Anne tried to figure it all out. Joni also gave up a baby for adoption. They became acquainted much later. But now 80, slowed by a rare disease and a brain aneurysm, she is the mother to so many female artists. Anne Powers is here. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here, Robin.
Well, so much to tackle. You spent 7 years on this. She had this unusual tuning that came from the polio paralysis in one hand. Oh, she had that painting, you know, did most of her covers. Let's just hear a little of the song Day After Day. This is the first composition she ever wrote. She dropped it on her archives, Volume 1, The Early Years in 2020.
Day after day, miles and miles of railroad track, night after night, humming of the wheels.
And while she was, you know, working the coffee houses in Canada, a Toronto music critic wrote about her high cheekbones, lustrous blonde hair, full lips and brilliant smile. Don't just let the looks of this girl dazzle you, though. Listen to her.
Yeah, well, it sums up something about music writing that's kind of embarrassing to me, a lifelong music writer, which is that even when a male music writer was trying to tell people to go beyond this woman's looks, he was still salivating over her. At the same time, the fact that he felt the need to say, don't just look at her, listen to her, she was remarkable, and people recognized her as such.
She also lived in a community when she, you know, went from Canada to New York and then out to L.A. and to Laurel Canyon. There's Graham Nash, Stephen Stills, Cass Elliott from the Mamas and the Papas, Jackson Browne. But she couldn't play the role of other women. There were groupie women. There were women who were very supportive wives and raising families.
Yeah, well, Joni figured out how to become one of the boys. She always characterized herself in some ways as a tomboy, you know, felt comfortable kind of code switching between feminine and masculine roles and positions. She does that in her music, but I think she was able to do that in her life and make alliances with these guys. Sometimes they were romantic, but oftentimes they were just as crucially creative. It was that total devotion to music making and creativity and art making that drove her and caused her to carve out this space.
Well, let's just take a second. The boys were also lovers, David Crosby, Graham Nash, but then some didn't know Jackson Browne, J.D. Souther, James Taylor, Leonard Cohen. But you know what?
It does, but I
get a little uncomfortable when people write about a woman having those relationships because they leave out that it was the men who were drawn to them, number one, the women. And also, in her case, it doesn't feel like bed notches. These feel like intense collaborations.
Yeah, well, famously, infamously, Rolling Stone magazine made a chart of all the liaisons from the height of the Laurel Canyon scene. Joni's name was on the chart surrounded by lipstick marks. Why wasn't David Crosby's name surrounded by lipstick marks? She was a studio rat. This was, you know, who she was making music with. And those musical connections are the truly important aspect of her life story. And that's really what I wanted to illuminate.
Right. Well, but just this idea of being a woman, Woodstock comes along and her managers don't want to send her there because everyone thinks it might be too dangerous. So she sent off to this other gig, you know, protecting her. And she had to watch it on TV, but then she gets the last word, literally.
Boy, did she, right?
Let's listen.
By the time we got to Woodstock, we were 500,000 strong, and everywhere there
It's pretty incredible that she wrote Woodstock just watching on television. I think that is a great example of Joni getting her revenge.
1971, Joni's moving on. She took a break in British Columbia, then Europe. She famously broke up with Graham Nash by letter, but wrote the album Blue, Every Song You Say, claiming her right to be said, My Old Man for Graham Nash, Little Green for the daughter she gave up for adoption. No one knew that at the time. And then A Case of You on the album.
I could drink a case of you, darling, and I would still be on my feet.
I love that it expresses her desire and her sensuality, and not just her heartbreak, and also like kind of toward her virility, you know?
But then, River.
I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I wish I had a river so long I would teach my feet to fly.
Well, River is an important song for me, thinking about Joni over her long career, because, you know, such a huge part of Joni's story is this impulse to move on, to escape, reach a place of solitude that would be an antidote, that impulse to skate away. Yeah. Also, of course, it is the great alternative Christmas carol for those people who maybe don't love the holidays, you know, or feel isolated. It's become the standard.
Yeah. Well, from there we go into the late 70s, the 80s, and her jazz turns. This brings us to Joni Mitchell's relationships with Black musicians and with apparently her desire to be seen at times as a Black man. Now, you and others have struggled to understand her dressing in what she described as a sleazy suit and an Afro wig, painting her face brown. It's an alter ego she called Claude, then Art Nouveau. She went to a party dressed as a Black man.
So many people let that go, gave her a pass for so many years. And I think, why?
You say gave her a pass because you think it was appropriation.
I mean, obviously it was appropriation. Obviously it was a transgressive act. But at the same time, one that she deeply believed she had the right to perform, you know, because she feels that the spirit of a Black man lives within her, or she has said that many times. It was a time when a lot of white musicians thought they had a right to adopt Black inflection in their singing styles, to align themselves with non-white artists and cultures without recognizing their own privilege. So she was hardly alone in that. But at the same time, that can't be a reason for us to move on without confronting the reality that it happened. This is the same time, Robin, when she's having her most fruitful and deepest collaborations with people like Wayne Shorter and Herbie Hancock.
Well, there's so much more. There's the music of the 90s, but I just want to jump to her orchestral turn. There were two orchestrated albums, the first one called Both Sides Now. It had Both Sides Now, A Case of You, and Standards, and then 2 years later, another album that was just her songs. That was Travelogue.
I'm so glad you highlight these orchestral albums. And she was working with her by-then ex-husband, Larry Klein. I mean, it is one of the most ingenious examples of an artist whose voice has changed over time, finding a new setting and a new way to present this more mature, more weathered voice. The arranger, Vince Mendoza, won a Grammy, but also the different tone that she reaches. She is the torch singer now. She is that woman in the dark cafe or the bar with Richard that we met in her song Last Time I Saw Richard. She is that person now.
I've looked at love from both sides now, from give and take, still somehow.
Well, and now we come to today. We know that she barely survived a brain aneurysm, but along comes Brandi Carlile, who, you know, helps her ascend to the throne as she sits on now so fans can adore her.
Yeah. I mean, Joni always appreciated those who thought she was great, but she also always pushed against the system and recognized the kind of artifice and constructed nature of what she called famously the star maker machinery. But, you know, she is in a period in her life of gratitude and of receptiveness. I always sense a gleam in Joni's eye, though, that she's laughing a little bit about it too, you know?
Help me, I think I'm falling in love again.
NPR music critic, author Ann Powers, her new book, A Deep Dive into Joni Mitchell's life, is traveling on bookshelves today. Ann, thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Our show comes to you thanks to the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Our stories today are produced by Peter O'Dowd, Ashley Locke, and Karen Miller-Metzen. Our editors are Todd Munt, Micaela Rodriguez, Michael Scotto, and Kat Welsh. Technical directors are Mike Moschetto and Michaela Varela. Mike Moschetto, Max Liebman, and Chris Bentley created the theme music. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. The executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. I'm Shirley Jihad. Thank you for being with us. Subscribe, and we'll see you next time.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Linda Mood Bell. Linda Mood Bell Summer Instruction for Reading, Comprehension, and Math can help students catch up or get ahead. Summer Instruction is designed to help children feel more confident, prepared, and excited about learning and school. Linda Mood Bell's evidence-based approach is individualized for all types of students with challenges that affect learning, including dyslexia. Learn more at lindamoodbell.com/NPR. Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
David Lynch's films explore dark themes, but in a rare interview on Wildcard this week, he says he's remarkably content, and you can be too.
We're supposed to be like little dogs with our tail just wagging and being happy, little smiles on our face all day long. This is the way it's supposed to be.
I'm Rachel Martin. Join us on NPR's Wildcard podcast, the game where cards control the conversation.